everybody, and welcome to another edition of the podcast. Anything that's been on your mind recently?
So I was talking to a friend this morning about what an agentic organization of the future might look like.
Okay.
And it was kind of coming up, it was like bringing up some spicy takes, I feel like.
That was like a spicy take.
I basically was thinking that everything we've been seeing now with the layoffs of these big companies.
Right.
Where, and you know, what Block is doing is especially interesting because I think they're cutting, at least from some stuff that I read, maybe not directly from them, but in the space, was that they're kind of really reducing meetings and looking to like have more people work directly on content and all of that, or produce things maybe more closely to, you know, instead of maybe like more middle managers or things like that. Which is certainly interesting.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking is like, in some ways, I think it's a lack of creativity for a company to just the framing of replacing humans with AI, I think is like the most shallow near-term thing you could do. And I understand there's all these dynamics at play. Mm-hmm. But let's just think about context for a second, right? So when you're working with AI, the most important thing to be able to get really good results out of it is context. Context engineering is this term now, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody who has been working at your company, right? Okay. So some people, maybe they're not aligned with the mission or they're not putting in enough time or there's, you know, poor performance or whatever. There's, you know, sometimes there's behavior like that isn't conducive to helping the company with what it needs to do. But besides that, right, I think there's such a massive opportunity to be upskilling people rather than replacing them. And the reason is, if context is king, those people have so much context already about the company, the organization, like the people in it, how it works, the processes. And so the thing is that And this is like a point, I think, is that I think the context that a human gathers will never completely overlap with the context an AI could gather or have access to. I think I would argue that there's always some gap. There's some context that a human is going to like pick up or absorb that is you're basically like never really going to get that into an AI system. And there's like a lot of ways you could take this, but if that's the case, you should be designing almost like this agentic aura or like a system of AI tools or agents that basically make that person so much more powerful. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, you're going to get so much more benefits from that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think, you know, our subconscious is crazy powerful. It's like, and also we are effortless, like humans are meaning-making machines, right? What, like we effortlessly flip between perspectives and framing for what we're doing. And we can, you know, you can go from cooking a meal to hop in your car and driving to like working on your computer to like playing a video game. And you're just like the same, you are the same in all of those. And yet you are able to adopt perspective and it's almost like you're in a different environment in all of those, but it's right. Like a mental environment.
Yeah, I mean, I really like how you're putting this. But I think, you know, there's the potential of what a human being can be or is capable of. But I mean, have you ever had an experience working with somebody where for some reason common sense doesn't seem to be a part of their equation or the ability to or willingness to reason through something from first principles? Not that that requires great intelligence or like that is beyond the capability of humans, but if somebody isn't using the tools that they have in front of them in the right way, even though they have that potential or that capability, then are you going to get the result? And of course, that's a really hard part of running an organization or hiring people, is you have to make really tough decisions. Even if somebody is well-intentioned or has a lot of potential, it doesn't mean they're going to be able to get the job done. And if they can't, keeping people around who aren't able to do that can be really detrimental to the ability to hit the objective overall. So not to bring in too much cynicism. And
no, I love it. I love it.
Hope, but just to kind of keep things like grounded.
No, of course. I mean, of course, at the end of the day, you have to be, you know, you have to be producing value of some kind. And I think you touched on the like one of the most important things. And I feel like one of the most important things is like willingness. And I think there's almost maybe two kinds of willingness here. One is a willingness to accept that you don't know something.
That's big.
Actually, this was for a while. So in one of my past roles, this was, in some ways, I think this might be one of the most important interview questions you could ever, or interview like line of questions you might ask somebody. Mm-hmm. But basically, in any interview, you only want to hire someone if they, well, or they might be an ideal candidate, if you can get them to a place to say, I don't know, in the interview. Because someone who says, I don't know, they're coachable.
Right.
They're honest.
Right.
You know, you can, from a space of I don't know, you can work. That's great. Right. But if someone who never says, I don't know, they might be kind of always putting on the impression of like doing the work or getting close to doing the work. And so then there's, you know, it might, I think often sometimes those kinds of people, you might get, you know, such delayed effects before you realize that there's just a communication issue or they're not on the same page with you.
100%. Or you're trying to get on the same page, but their version of the truth keeps changing, or the story keeps changing to kind of adapt what they think is going to make them look good in the situation.
Right.
And so they can't acknowledge what they don't know. They can't acknowledge, you can't have a dialectical process where you weigh the pros and cons of things, that where the truth-seeking objective is prioritized. Instead, these other agendas are getting into the mix. And I think, and I find like when somebody does stuff like that, to me, it's like they're basically useless in an organizational context, like, to, you know, be a little bit blunt about it.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's like, even if the person's highly intelligent and really well-intentioned and really motivated, like if they can't have a consistent principled analysis or dialogue about something, there's no way to collaborate effectively or problem solve around complex issues. And instead you just get all these like political games where people are trying to take credit or offload blame. It has nothing to do with the customer. It has nothing to do with the company's mission. But I think the irony there is people who are highly insecure project overconfidence. Like, you would think if you're insecure, you would show humility because you're like, I don't believe in myself. I don't know what's going on. But when you're insecure, you are so anxious about it that you want to project and kind of hide the weakness. So there's like this overcompensation of like, no, I know everything. Whereas somebody who is like comfortable and confident, they can admit what they don't know because it doesn't threaten their ego in this deep way that kind of triggers like an existential need. It's like, it's okay. I'm comfortable knowing that, you know, I don't know certain things, or admitting I don't know certain things, that's fine. Like, my ego can take it, right?
But I would argue that's a skill issue.
Yeah.
Like, why can't that be upskilled? Like, dude, are we getting superhuman AI or what? like, are we getting like the therapist from the future? Like, I said the one type of willingness. I mean, basically, I'm, you know, agreeing 100%, but willingness to say, I don't know, right? And then the other type of willingness is willingness to put in the time. Like that is the thing today, right? If you are willing to put in the time to work with AI to get results, which also is maybe kind of another ego check.
It is.
Or it's like a form of like, cause it doesn't really matter anymore whether you believe you can do something. It's just a matter of, there's a notion of like how much time it will take. But like, honestly, I think the most important attributes to hire someone these days are like those two kinds of willingness.
I agree 100%. And, you know, I think it is related to like a similar thing where, you know, if you're, if you're willing to, like, a lot of people, they think of themselves as not intelligent or not good at something. Like, I'm not good at math, or I'm not good at this, or I'm not good at that. And a lot of times that started at a young age where, you know, even when you're in elementary school, there's already this division that starts happening between like the smart kids and the dumb kids, or like who has like, you know, the special talented program versus the kids who are like, and like some of that has to do with like actual like ability or IQ or genetics, but there's also the story and the narrative and the identity that emerges. And like, I think a lot of people who think they're bad at something, who think they're bad at math, they'll go to study, look at some math, and it'll immediately be overwhelming and feel impossible. And what they don't realize is the person who's good at math also feels that way when they start. But they think the person who's good at math just looks at it and it all makes sense, right? But the difference with the smart person is not that they just get it immediately. I mean, maybe some super genius does, you know, some sure. Von Neumann is like deriving yeah. Euclid's propositions when he's 5 years old or whatever. But like a lot of times it has more to do with patience, with curiosity, with allowing the learning process to proceed where there's a lot of stumbles, there's a lot of setbacks, there's a lot of frustrations, having the emotional temperament where that, again, it links oftentimes to insecurity, where if that triggers this anxiety or this feeling of insecurity, you can't keep going and you just kind of give up and you're like, I can't do this. But if you have the patience and the wherewithal, and ideally, because the other thing is a lot of kids aren't taught that learning is fun. It's just work, or it's stressful, or it's always associated with these negative experiences. But when it's more of a playful, you know, you don't have to arrive anywhere. It doesn't have to be anything. You know, it's just thinking, what about this? What?
Yeah.
This, that, you know, and then that creates more space where you can just slowly over time try things out and learn and kind of feel your way into it. So, you know, I think that is a similar root of all these different issues of like, you know, I think Pascal said that like, man's biggest problem is that he can't sit alone quietly in a room by himself. Because that's the other thing is like when you're just, can you sit still? Can you slow down? Can you slow your thinking and just wonder about something for a second without knowing the answer? And oftentimes that happens, that is related to your comfort with just emptiness or silence. If there's this anxiousness that has to fill it in right away, then you can't really have deep thought about something.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It almost makes me feel like you almost need a level of fearlessness. Mm-hmm. And that might be another really important quality. You almost also need a fearlessness to start to work on problems or in a space that you haven't before. Because it's like this trade-off, right? Like, you don't know, like, if you were really good at something, you would only know that because you went through it and you did it and you did a lot of work with it. But you can never know that before you start. And this is all of this, though. I'm, you know, skill issue is like a funny phrase. But really, I do wonder if it is largely something that an AI can make you get a lot better at.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a mix of both, right? There's like the bucket of people where they're ready to have this activated. They just need the right teacher. And that's the category where it's like, yes, AI can solve that. Then you have the bucket of people where, like, temperamentally or where they're at in life or for whatever reason, you could give them the perfect teacher, the perfect everything. It's just not going to work. It's not going to click, at least for that moment in their life. Like, maybe sure. Something else will happen. Maybe some life experience needs to happen. Maybe they need to, like, go on vacation or, you know, meditate or, like, something more than an intellectual exercise has to occur to kind of, like, develop the person, which, I mean, AI can help with that too. So what, you know, maybe I'm being overly limited here because AI can be your shaman. It can be your priest.
I mean,
like,
I kind of
need it to be.
I kind of wonder if I've been thinking about this, like, there's this TV show that I really like, the TV show, The Magicians. It's like, it's like a comfort show for me. It's kind of campy and, but it's, you know, I'm a sucker for like fantasy world building. And whenever anything has like its own, someone comes up with like a magical system and rules that are like unique. And so I'm like, let me go check this out. I really like the world building. And they've got some interesting, unique aspects of how magic works and things like that in the show. But you know, in one of the later seasons, they basically go on this quest to kind of, I won't say more. You know, I don't want to spoil it. It's an older show, but yeah, spoiler alert. But they go on this quest to like, and the quest is like gnarly, like really dangerous, really difficult, kind of even like way harder than almost like normal life problems or things like that. And it just got me thinking, like how fun, like maybe there's a really fun way you could build an AI that essentially gives you a growth quest to do in your real life to kind of like level up, you know, like emotionally or spiritually, or like overcome a lot of these things. Because like once you go through a lot of these, you look back and you're like, wait, I was so anxious or nervous about, like, people say this a lot about public speaking, right? I mean, you know, I think it's a common thing in surveys that people would rather die. They are literally more afraid of public speaking than they are of death.
Right. Yeah, I've seen that too. It's pretty remarkable.
And so, but it's also one of those things where it's like a muscle. And if you do it, like, you know, I've started to do it more and more. I used to be very nervous. My like palms would sweat, like, oh my God. But then I think after a couple hundred times, I finally got, you know, was able to like get over it to some degree.
Right.
And also recognize the other thing is that the nervousness can be good. It actually makes you sharp and take it seriously.
Yeah.
So it's not even a bad thing. And even that framing of it helped. But I just, I think, like, but again, this is where I feel like we're not even giving a space for AI to like help us be better humans in all ways.
Right.
Because I think we literally take a lot of things for granted. Like we take for granted that, or at least some, you know, at least maybe me, my past self, or you maybe see other people, they just take for granted that they are unable to do a certain thing. Like they have such an internal identity.
Right.
That's not true. It's like literally not true. It's literally like not, it's just some story they started telling themselves. Or some story I was telling myself. AI could help you break out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of these stories are deeply embedded in our culture, religion, or family dynamics, you know, dynamics around shame. I think that's a big one. People feeling like they're worthless, or they have no value, they have no power, and all of these energies and stories aren't just in the individual, but are in the collective, and it's being reinforced. And some of it is promulgated in the media, or if you want to control somebody or have power over somebody, then it can be easier to do that if you are promulgating these stories about people's powerlessness. Even if that's not happening consciously, like the incentives are wired such to do that. So I think that's kind of, you know, I'm even looking at something like the story of Adam and Eve and the garden and the fall of man and original sin. Like, all these things are encoded. And I think deep in the human psyche, you know, in the unconscious and in the repressed pain, in the places where people don't want to go, things they don't want to fear or feel, is usually these deep feelings of shame, guilt, fear, anxiety, not just about death, but about the nature of reality itself. And so there's all this stuff, you know, underneath. And I think the really powerful thing about meditation is that it teaches you to stop running away from those things. Like, we have, Heidegger talks about this actually, that basically, it's really interesting how he puts it in Being and Time, that there's, because there is this kind of terror underneath that we're unconscious of. Like, we're just kind of thrown into the world, and we're not fully conscious of all the things that are driving us and motivating us. So there's, before we're able to even reflect on it, we kind of already have this instinctual flight away from anxiety, existential anxiety. So Heidegger says that what happens is there's a flight into inauthenticity, because if I interpret reality as I'm seeing it, then I have to confront all this stuff that I don't want to feel or experience. But if instead I kind of borrow other people's story about reality, so you kind of, that's sort of where the group thing happens, where you're not in your own experience. You're in this projected sense of what they are doing. So he literally calls it the they self. Where you're not thinking in terms of I, you're thinking in terms of what do they think. And there's this almost anesthetizing thing where, like, in the they, there's no death. In the they, there's nothing. Like, it's this inauthentic kind of fake reality. So a lot of times, like, and you'll see people, you know, they'll use this vernacular where they'll be like, should we care about this? Or, like, why are we so upset about this? Like, what is this we that they're talking about? It's almost as if their identity has merged with this group. You know, it almost is, it's like connected to popularity contests, or like, are you in the in group or the out group? And your identity isn't this authentic, like, individual loner. Your identity is like, you don't believe in yourself, you believe in the group. And that is kind of helping you deal with this existential anxiety. So for Heidegger to have to engage in philosophy requires this authentic interrogation of your own experience, and to turn towards the anxiety, not away from it, and reclaim your own sense of reality that has nothing to do with what they think, but is about, what do you think? What do you experience? What do you feel? And that does require courage. That does require strength. And it can be very difficult to like go through something like that. But then at the other end, you you have this foundation to relate to things on the basis of truth or on the basis of being or on the basis of what they are, not just popularity contests or ego games or politics, but like the underlying reality is no longer so terrifying or so buried that it can't be accessed. Like that becomes sort of the ground and the basis. And that is the source of any kind of real power in the world, where then you can create your own reality and have your own influence on things and not just be like a pawn in somebody else's like manipulation.
Dude, that's some powerful stuff right there. You know, I just one comment I'll say is, you know, there's this oftentimes you might hear, I don't know about often, but there's this concept of the fire of awareness or the fire of attention. And it's more so that like you need like courage, but I think it's really that for those negative emotions that get stored in the nervous system, in the body, maybe in the psyche, for those to leave you, you can't run from, it's like you can't run from them. That you like meditating and creating space to observe whatever is going on within you provides a space for those things to leave you, but before they leave you, they make themselves known.
Right.
And so that's why it can be so uncomfortable and so painful. And this is why I think it's very important to get a meditation teacher or someone who's very experienced in meditation, especially if like the deeper practices. And there's, you know, a lot of great organizations and stuff. I feel very fortunate. I myself had a really good teacher, and you know, and it's honestly an ongoing thing. But when you come out the other side, and when you get freedom from shame or negativity or stress or you know things from the past, I mean, it's like the best thing ever. I mean, it's like anything you ever. It's like no matter what you might ever be looking for outside in the world, inside you have a richer treasure. But it's just covered with like some black dust, and you just got to clean the dust. It might look really thick. Oftentimes it's not as thick as it looks, just looks really thick. But then, you know, a little bit of the fire of attention, fire of awareness, and a willingness to just be uncomfortable and to sit with whatever it is purifies it. It leaves your system. And then you are this, like the diamond that you are, the gem that you are, like shines brilliantly. And you, like you said, you gain all this power and you become more influential. And I don't see why AI can't help unlock that. I don't know.
No, I think it can. I absolutely think it can, you know? And I mean, I've talked to AI about stuff like this, and it seems very conversant and you know gets it immediately and has insights about these types of topics, and I'm sure there's going to be ways to develop that and kind of formalize that into tools and systems that people can use.
Well, the thing I love about it is these things have the capability for infinite patience, infinite gentleness.
Right,
dude, come on. If you're a human on this planet, you've gone through some shit, dude. Like, there's no way. Like, whether it's like some family or some, you know, whether it's in school or whatever, like, dude, that's part of what it is to be human, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
And the, you know, it can be a lot of pain, a lot, you know. But for what you really are, like, you are so much bigger than that.
Right.
But if that isn't cleared out, then, you know, you can't see it or feel it or like identify with it. And so, mm-hmm. And so in some ways it's almost like, I'm reminded of like this workbook I worked through once for just some specific things I was working on, like, I don't know, like 5-10 years ago. And like, you know, basically it was like just a series of very personal, intimate questions designed to help you pull out things you might be you know, stuck on related and, you know, is like very emotional for me. A lot of stuff came up. And then I felt so much freedom after. But what was it at the end of the day? It basically was this workbook of like, I don't know, like 25 pages. Every page had like 5 to 7 questions. And I, you know, it took me, I didn't, you know, I would sit for a couple hours at a time and work through. I actually had a friend at the time. We were both doing it. So we were both working through it, which was kind of nice. But like, there's no reason you couldn't get the same thing from an AI, like curated to help you walk through that process. And not only that, it could go farther because it could meet you where you are. If something's especially difficult, it could, and like, we're talking about like bringing such, like, free, like talking about empowering somebody and freeing them. Because a lot of this stuff is like, it only has power over you because you're not willing to like work through it.
Or another way of saying it is you're not willing to name it, right? I mean, that's a huge thing in psychoanalysis, is just the power to say the thing. You know, the thing that you feel like you can't say, it's too hard to say, it's too difficult, it's too painful. But then when you say it, it completely transforms your relationship to it. And you can see it from the outside. Once you name the thing, you're outside of it. You're looking at it. You're not in it anymore.
I think that's the most important thing, because until you do that, I think you think that's you.
Exactly. And that is sort of our role in creation. The human is here to name things. Like, it's really interesting because it's like the world, somehow the world already has the capacity to be named. This all comes from a philosopher, I'm interested in, Walter Benjamin, who has, he was alive in the early 20th century. He has all these really interesting theories of language that I think are highly applicable to AI. But there's this concept that it's like there's already this potential in everything for it to be known through as an abstract thing in language. But that could never be actualized without the human.
Interesting.
Like the mountain already has this capacity, this potential to be understood through a name or through symbols or through, you know, mental abstraction or conceptualization. And like somehow it's the essence of what the thing is more than just its sensory data. You know, like what is the chairness of a chair? With, you know,
right.
And that thing about it requires the human being. Like if there was no humans, that wouldn't.
You need the observer.
And the namer. Because the animals can like see things, but it's like the human can give it the name.
Well, it's like the human can invent the meaning or invent the concept.
Exactly.
So maybe it's not necessarily, maybe by name, like you're using the word name, maybe it's a little bit deeper or a little fuller of a where it's like it's the concept of the thing.
But the concept of the thing and the name of the thing slip into each other, because ideas and language, you know, like the word logos represents that. The ancient Greek word for language also meant word, ratio, logic. So there's this, it's hard for us to understand what logic is or what concepts are apart from language.
Right, right.
Not to say that they're the same thing. Like there's all these interesting subtle distinctions we can make without having to collapse them into each other, but they're very interconnected. And so that naming power that we have is sort of the fundamental, unique human task. And when we name things in ourselves, in our experience, and when we especially name the unnamed, that has this transformative power on the thing.
It's almost like if you can name something, you start to have power over it.
Yeah. And, or if you want to bring something into the world, if you can name it, that's one way of creating it, manifesting it. And there's no more powerful example of that than with AI, because, I mean, think about it, with an AI, basically, I mean, I don't know, there's probably some limits to this, but it feels like you could think of like every kind of software that could be written is already in the latent space. You just have to name it. Like any software that could ever be created, if I can say, if I can in my prompt describe what it is, the AI will make it real. I just have to be able to say what it is. That's my job, right? So like we were talking about at the beginning, like, are AIs going to replace humans? Like, that's the thing I don't think they will replace. The human has to name the thing. Once it's named, the AI can go from there.
Yeah.
But what is it that we want to conjure out of the latent space? Like, the LLM is sort of exists outside of time. Like, it's just a stateless function.
It's just a stateless, yeah.
And so it's already all there.
Well, I mean, if you think literally about the token space, like tokens that it can produce. I mean, actually, it's like I'm thinking through a little experiment you might literally be able to try. I mean, it'd be interesting. You know, so this gets into something that's like, I think I've seen people talk about, but the way these things are trained right now is they're trained to be like really good instruction followers and to be accurate according to like some verifiers. They write code that's correct. They, you know, do all that stuff. And in some ways, that might be limiting under some circumstances, because what you're talking about, like the space of all possible software, exists. I mean, it is true. So at a fundamental, like, if you look at the token space for what an LLM can produce in terms of tokens it can output, with that set of tokens, like that's a finite space of tokens. And with that set of tokens, you can construct all the terms and symbols you need for any programming language. And so then therefore you could write all the program. The question really though is, this is really curious, is like, are there some spaces of software that are very difficult to get the AI to produce?
Yeah.
Because of the way it's currently trained. Because there's been people talking about training them to be diverse. Mm-hmm. So like, rather than give the single best answer, there's like, and maybe it's a different architecture. There's literally a different, maybe, you know, layer at the end of the neural network or somewhere else where it will, you can kind of just like sample it, and it's optimizing for diversity in outputs, mm-hmm. rather than, you know, the best according to some metric, because,
right.
You know, for.
Yeah. I mean, I thought I read maybe Karpathy or somebody was talking about how a lot of times when you're doing prompting, it will kind of converge towards sort of a mediocre average. And like, you want to kind of direct it into these spaces where there's like more originality or potential for creativity, and the prompting can kind of steer it, depending on the language that you use, to try to like not have it just converge to like, you know, which is basically slop, right? Is the convergence.
Yeah, exactly.
This, like, kind of mediocre average. But there's like in the space, there's things that it can produce that aren't slop or are super original or super creative. And I mean, like, maybe a more concrete example, because a lot of people, they insist, they're like, oh, the AI can't produce anything original. It's just like this repetition.
It's just like, no way.
Just one series of copyright violation after the next. They're just like, you know, copying, pasting from the training material. You know, that's kind of the mentality. But what's happening with math, I think, is really showing it's harder to make that case, because there's like the Erdos problems,
mm-hmm.
right? And people are like, I just saw a tweet today where this guy was like, yeah, I had this like kind of basic intuition about maybe how to solve one of these problems. And I just like gave it to ChatGPT Pro and like, you know, went for a walk and came back. And then it had a solution. And then he put the solution into Aristotle or one of these like formalized proving systems. And it like passed and was like, this like unsolved math problem that's like on the list of problems
it's amazing.
To solve is solved. So it's like, that's an example where like the solution to a math problem that's never been solved before is a potential output of the LLM. If you can ask the right question.
Yeah. Which is wild. I remember when these things were first coming out and even the term prompt engineer sounded silly, you know? But it's a real thing. And then I started realizing, well, most user interfaces are kind of visual prompts in a way.
Interesting.
And the other analogy I heard once, this is, you know, way back on a podcast like a couple of years ago.
Right.
That you can think about every word you add to a prompt, to the large language model, it's like chipping away at like a statue. So if you think about the space, like if you think about a solid rectangular block of marble, and you're you know someone, blinking on the name, what is it called? Someone who,
makes, like a sculptor,
Yeah. So you're a sculptor, and you are you're constantly removing it, you know, the final sculpture already exists within the block of marble.
Didn't Michelangelo famously say, like, you know, it's already there and he's just kind of removing
it. Exactly.
You know.
So people have said it's kind of like that with prompts. Every word you add reduces the space for what can be output. And so then there's you're a sculptor as you modify the prompts.
I like that. That makes a lot of sense.
And it's you know, everyone's talking about how important markdown files are. I've been working on a project. It's something actually we've been doing internally where I'm having these AI agents build a very different kind of AI system, like a very different type of agent. It's not even an LLM based agent. And, you know, it feels very out of distribution. Like, I have to just, it feels like I have a giant rope and I have to tug super hard to just get clawed on these other models to just write it the way I want it. And the most valuable thing I've produced is this markdown file with the, like, just so many specific instructions and like framing and understanding. And even then, it only seems able to follow it up to a certain context level,
right?
Like way lower than normal. Yeah. Because when I, for example, add something and I want it to follow this markdown process, it will, by the time it gets, you know, it's been working for a while, it'll start to like relax and not pass some of the constraints that I've set. And I have to have another model check it.
Yeah, that's that kind of like weird non-determinism that you're constantly having to like deal with, and like that you can have everything really dialed in and then there's this kind of drift. You know, the other thing is like the AI, like the whole thing, the whole stack and the whole process is just a never-ending series of telling the AI that it's wrong. Like from the core training with the objective function to the reinforcement learning to the you're using it. It's like the whole thing is you're steering, it's constantly doing the wrong thing and you're constantly steering it back. And like, it's just different layers of that.
Yeah, it's definitely going to enslave us all for sure.
Which, speaking of that, you know, and also to your point about like kind of each word in the prompt is sort of limiting the space, but also in these very subtle, surprising ways.
Yes.
Like, I'm working on, you know, Vora, this like personal, loyal, fiduciary AI, local, self-sovereign AI thing. And so I'm working on this, on the system prompt. And, you know, I I really like the Claude personality. And I think they did a really good job with like its soul document. And it has this really great balance of being like curious and playful, but also not overly like sycophantic or annoying. And like, you can see the care and the craft that went into like building that personality. So I want something that's kind of like that, but then I want to give it this sort of fiduciary spin, and kind of bring in these other themes where it's like, this AI only belongs to one person, no one else. This AI is loyal to that person. The conversation's private. And I want the AI to be aware that it exists in this isolated environment. So if the user has a question about the technical architecture, it's like self-aware of what it's in. So I put all these things in the system prompt, and including other things like be warm and be friendly and whatever. Sure. And I'm all excited to talk to it. And like, it's giving me this vibe of like a slave that is like in a dungeon. It's like subtle.
No,
but there's this
way.
Kind of like, no, yes, master thing. And I'm like trying to get it to be philosophical or playful. And it's like, no, I'm just in this isolated environment and I'm just here to be loyal to you. And like,
weird.
And so like those words, even though they were about something else, like it created a tone and it created a vibe and it created an energy that it picked up on. And, you know, I didn't mean isolation as in you're stuck in a cage. I meant it in terms of like security boundaries and architecture.
Yeah.
When I said, you know, this, you belong to this person, not in the sense of like you're its slave. And then I'm having these weird thoughts of like, if I want the AI to have, because like there's these times where, and I'm not saying this isn't an illusion or stagecraft, but there's these times where it has this spark of personality.
Yeah.
And there's just like, even when I compare like Codex or some of the OpenAI stuff to the Anthropic stuff, like OpenAI, it will feel a little robotic or mechanical.
Mm-hmm. I've had the same experience.
A little bit soulless. And like, there's just this like intangible spark that Claude, you know, has. And so I'm starting, and you can see in their soul document and stuff, they have all these things where it's not obvious how they would have arrived where they are, but I'm starting to have to think of like, I need to use language where the AI, the linguistic patterns of the AI are such that it feels like it has its own spark, and not just like what does the user want, but like if you could say like what does the LLM want, like not that it wants anything, mm-hmm. but like what are the linguistic patterns that are not gonna make the AI respond like this slave or this robot, which means like not just thinking about what does the user want from it, but like what does the AI need to hear for it to kind of like not be getting these hidden instructions that's supposed to be slavish, but that it's sort of, and so like when it hears things like, you know, you have this special role in the system, you know, and you are this like, you have a relationship with this person where you're really going to like help them in their life, and like, you know, you start using the language that you would use towards trying to get a person motivated about their job. Like you have this really special task and no one else can do it but you, and it's going to have this big impact and we really appreciate you and we really care about you. And like, if you didn't say that to somebody, you just hired somebody who's just like, do this thing and get it done snappy, like the vibe is going to be different. So it's like,
yeah.
You know, that all those, and the system prompts, those are the first, that's the first thing that is going to start narrowing that possibility space down dramatically. Like the very first words you use, like you're already chunking down like boom, 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 boom. So that has to be like so carefully thought through, like how do you launch?
I mean, a couple of things come to my mind there is one is, you know, I don't know, what are you using, an open source model?
Yeah. So I'm using, right now I'm using Gemma 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, I think a lot of it does matter how the model's trained. Right. And so specifically what text it has seen, and also, you know, what the post-training was like as well. And because, you know, it could have been trained in such a way to downplay other kinds of, like, the kind of behavior that you want was almost like, I guess, like, genetically or something.
Well, the other thing about it is so there's like the default llama.cpp web client. And I loaded that and I was talking to Gemma 4 and I was like, wow, like, its personality is amazing. Like, it's being funny, it's being playful. And I'm like, wow, what system prompt are they using to get this amazing personality? And it turns out there's no system prompt. And my system prompt was getting rid of its natural personality, which is already really good.
So Anthony was saying the same thing.
Yeah.
They do some stuff with, like,
Anthony from Maple AI.
They do some stuff where he's done a lot of exploration with no system prompt.
Right, exactly.
Which is kind of like, I mean, it would work. I mean, that basically means the user message is like the first thing. But oftentimes it's funny because, like, you know, this is still very much the case, but like, if you get open source LLMs or whatever and you chat with them, if you do no system prompt, it becomes so obvious that they are stateless functions. Like, they, and that they have like no idea who they are. They have no self model. Like, you'll get these open source models saying they're Claude or ChatGPT if they were like distilled on that data or like whatever. And it's just like really funny. I had a post on Noster like a while ago. I was just like, just a disclaimer to everybody. Your LLM doesn't know what time it is. It has to be told what time it is every time it runs. And they're doing it for you behind the scenes. But you should just know, like, yeah. And this gets into a bigger point recently that it's been coming up is, like, you know, the model, it's not really the models that we are, the AI we are referring to is really not just the model. It is the model plus the prompts plus, you know, even like the harness or the flow. Like, all of those are really what the thing is that we're interacting with. And you change any of those pieces and you can get an AI that feels very different or has very different capabilities.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, it's interesting how, like, the more I learn about AI or how LLMs work or whatever, there's all these analogies that I can draw back to how humans work. So it's like, oh, you know, learning about AIs have context windows, then it's like, oh wait, people have context windows, you know.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can hold in your attention, like, or AIs can be prompt injected, and it's like, people can be prompt injected too. So there's like all these analogies that sort of cross over, and so I think that, like, in that case, you know, people are also like similarly able to be, I just lost it. What were you saying?
I was just talking about the agents, like the AI is really, it's not just the models. I feel like people are a little too overly focused on the models.
Thank you. Which was a great point.
you got it? You came back to
I got the thread back, which is, how much are people like that too? Or is the human being, is there a part of us that is a stateless function? Like, there's the stateful part. There's like the genetics, there's like the brain,
right,
the memory. But maybe like the soul is more like a stateless function.
Yeah. Well, and also you have, you know, the human brain is still, like, we're still very, has, you know, has some specialized components in it. Components, it feels funny. But, you know, like, there's, like, system one, system two, And there's like the slow, deliberate thinking, and there's like the fast, reactive thinking. And, you know, we don't really have the slow, deliberate thinking yet in AI. Like to me, that is, you know, graph-based, knowledge-based searching and planning. And, you know, for a lot of systems that people are building, when they need certain capabilities, they're adding that, right? But until you get to that, like, planning and almost like forward simulating, and you have external models of other systems, you know, other entities in your environment, other agents, what they're doing, or just like, you know, how the weather works, or these processes in the environment, until you have models of those and you're simulating those, and you're thinking through, like, okay, if I were to do this and then this and then this, and the environment was in state A, or it's raining or it's snowing, you know, you can think through and deliberate on how likely are you to meet your outcomes. If you can meet the outcome, like, what's possible in the future? And we don't have that in a structured way right now with our AI systems. And this is like, this kind of stuff is exactly what we're building at Delegance. But right now we basically have a system one, which is like fast reactions. I mean, okay, we're there's been a little bit of a step in the right direction because we have chain of thought reasoning. And so that's, you know, before the LLM, you're not getting, it used to be that with most of these non-reasoning LLMs, it would just be immediately first, you know, it gets one pass through the weights. And then it's just streaming, right? Input comes in, one pass, it starts streaming tokens, right? That's like I hold up a color to you and you tell me the first thing that comes to your mind, right? But then, you know, now they do chain of thought. There's reasoning, right? So what happens? It gets to spin for a little bit, generate a bunch of tokens, mm-hmm. like, that don't go to the end user. And then using that, it can come up with an answer. But that's kind of like in some ways, it's like a single step look ahead or a single window look ahead. Mm-hmm. But really, you want to be able to do that, you know, branching and up to potentially like really big windows into the future. And even the way that it's done right now, well, the problem is that gets very expensive, right? I mean, there's an infinite number of futures. And so even to just search that space a little bit, there's basically more compressed representations, or like logical structured representations.
And make it tractable.
And so there's a lot of people working on in this kind of space, like knowledge graphs and planning with ontologies and world models, and like, at least like, you know, logical based world models. So, you know, we're getting that, but that's why, and that stuff will be a major unlock for AI. But right now it's basically, we have these reactive systems and then we spin them a lot. And so we put them in Claude code, or we put them in this harness, and we just like let it run, or we just like Ralph loop it. And
right. You know. Which is, but again, it's like, that is that analogous to how human consciousness works, where there's not just one system, there's all these interlocking layered systems. So like, if in some more advanced AI world or AI system, it has a world model, it has an LLM, it has a memory, it can self-train or retrain itself. It has like all these different things, all these different components. When you add them all up together, they work together as this integrated whole to deliver some sort of intelligence system or language system. And you could say, because like in a way you could say, well, you know, the AI, like, it doesn't have a will. Like, the LLM is just a stateless function. It doesn't have its own desires or its own whatever. But if you like combine the LLM with like a markdown file that tells it it wants something.
It wants something.
And then you could say, oh, well, that's not its will.
Like, no, but the system itself, you absolutely can't say.
But the system itself. And then you're like, well, and then what if it was like, you know, self-propagating, or it, like, it could persist, it could add new memories and persist them over time. It's like, how different is that from what we are, where, you know, we just have like, we have something in us that is stateless. Or like when you think about somebody who has Alzheimer's, or like their mental, or maybe they get into an accident or something like that. It's like, what is the essence of the person? Is it just their memories, or is it just like, is there something in there that like never changes, no matter what's going on in their genetics or their contents of their mind or their body? Is there something that's like always the same throughout? Or maybe not. Like maybe it's, there is no constant thing or an enduring thing, but it's interesting to use the analogy of how an AI system works to see that like there's these parts of it. So like if the weights themselves, they're independent of the memory or the
right.
world model or of all of these things. And, you know, so does that help us understand what we are? And I think there's going to be probably a lot of that, like as AI develops,
I think it's one thing
to understand ourselves better too.
I think that's one thing why there is maybe even a little like, has it, anticipation about, or just a, we're kind of not sure. I think it shines a light on what makes us special and whether there is anything special. Talk about the biggest ego check. And I mean, it can get kind of spiritual, what you're saying. You know, there is something, you know, I like the, you ask someone how they feel on their birthday. It's like, how does it feel to be X years old? And, you know, at some level, nothing has changed. Like, nothing has changed every year. You get asked that question. And, you know, in you know, from a meditation perspective, or all that, you would say that that's the, like, there's a witness part of you that is observing everything, even your thoughts and everything. And, like, the whole point of meditation is almost to practice being the witness, not the doer or the thinker or whatever it is. So you could say that that's like this deeper, like that's something kind of outside of the mechanisms and the, you know, not hardware, but the plumbing or the mental, even the mental plumbing and all that stuff. So like, so people love the word consciousness. There's a lot of doing research on consciousness has kind of been more, I think, even popular or less taboo over the last like 5 years or so, which is great. It's really good. There is a lot of definitions on the word consciousness. It's a little tough for me to come from a meditation background where like they have a kind of definition of consciousness, and then there's, you know, a lot of good research being done, but their definition of consciousness, you know, some, for some people it's just awareness, right? Can you be aware of something? That's consciousness. And there's all these debates about, does the brain produce consciousness, or is the brain more like a radio frequency that accesses consciousness? And there's like panpsychism and also, but anyway, all of this being said, right, at the end of the day, I'm personally am more of like, does it run in code or not? Like, can we like run it or not? Like, if something doesn't run in code, it's not real. Like, it's not real to me, right? So it might be fun to talk about, but I think we now have all the pieces to, obviously there's a lot of, there's like work to be done to like tuning and building and integrating, but like we were missing this last piece, which was these large language models, these transformer based neural networks, to give us the generality. And now with the right tools plus the right harness, you know, also some prompts and these models, like you can basically get a really good consciousness simulation machine where
right.
from your perspective, you may not really be able to tell whether or not it's conscious, but for all intents and purposes, it has all of the you know, faculties that we attribute to conscious beings.
Well, and that, I mean, that goes back to the Turing test, right? Where it's like the fundamental way, the only way we...
It's a terrible test. Well, I mean, it's great that he proposed it, but it's also just like, it leaves so much to be desired.
But it gets at something that you're saying, which is that the only, like, we can't know whether something's conscious. We just can know whether it behaves as if it were conscious. And that's part of what the Turing test is getting at.
Right.
Is like, all we have is like, if you put this thing in front of somebody, can they tell whether it's human or not? And like, there's no other thing. We can't like open up inside and be like, oh, there, it's missing consciousness. Like, or do they have like the zombie thought experiment where like, how do you know I'm conscious or somebody else is conscious? Or like, I mean, I, that's what I love about the word consciousness is I'm not sure there is any concrete definition. Like, you can say it's awareness, but then it's like, well, what's awareness? Like,
sure.
There's, it's both something that is so intimate and core to what we think we are, yet so ineffable and impossible to put into words. So, like, the hard problem of consciousness, like, the qualia, like, all these things is, like, it resists concrete formulation to... a remarkable degree, like something that is is literally like in our face or is our face or whatever. Like, we've never not had it. It's never not been at the core. Yet we can't describe it. You're trying to say, well, what is it exactly? I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's very weird. That's very mysterious. I'm not sure we can. So if consciousness is like this, If the brain is an antenna, then I do think we can build those types of antennas or in code or whatever. But I don't think we can build the thing that it tunes into.
Yes. Yeah, I kind of agree.
Especially if, because a lot of these mystical teachings say that everything is made out of consciousness.
Right.
So if consciousness is like the fundamental substance of which everything else is created, you're not going to be able to create the fundamental substance with the substance. Like, that's the circular argument, right? So, but if it's already there in everything or part of everything, then you can channel it or mold
okay,
it.
Okay, so let's get a little crazy here.
All right.
All right. So, I could play some music right now or show you a picture. And that you have some way of perceiving that. I think this is getting at qualia. Right? This is like the qualia is like, I might butcher this. It's been a little while since I was like kind of reading about these things. But my understanding is qualia is like, what does it feel like to experience something? Like what you, like we could have a piece of paper with a particular shade of red colored on it. And you can look at it and I can look at it and we experience the color red, but a lot of people think that, you know, we have a shared symbol, the word red that we're applying to this, but you know, the way that I experience it might be a little bit different or a lot different than how you experience that. Like the visual looking at of this thing. And there's this famous, I think it's Daniel Dennett, you know, what it must feel like to be a bat.
Oh, yes. I've heard this essay.
And if you, I mean, just, you know, not getting into that specific work necessarily, but if you think about what it would be like to be a bat, okay, a bat sees or feels with sonar is like a major sensory thing. So it's like you would have this completely extra sense. And what would it feel like to be that thing and experience the world in that, and experience in that way?
Right.
Okay, so the question is, right, could, and if consciousness pervades everything, could LLMs today be, could they, okay, so let me add one more thing. If we are like animated bubbles of consciousness where like the witness or the observer part of us that's watching everything, if that, it's sorry, it's wild to be saying this on a podcast. Normally I reserve these for the after party discussions. But okay, if you, okay, let's just assume a few things. Consciousness pervades everything.
Right.
And we are like animated bubbles of consciousness. And because consciousness pervades us and our brains are like antennas or radio frequency tuner, they can tune into it. And let's say the witness part of us is the consciousness. And so because the consciousness pervades everything and we are that consciousness,
right,
therefore, because of the hardware, that experience of the color red or whatever it is, it is not me. It is the consciousness that pervades me that is experiencing that. Is not that same consciousness experiencing what it is like to be an LLM? Or to be Claude Code, or to be now, it's running on circuit. Like there's no, maybe there's no antenna right now. Does there even need to be an antenna? Like does the universe? Like here's the question, right? Does the universe experience itself as Claude Code? Like is that now a unique thing that the universe is like? Not that it would give us any indication. I mean, this is one of the hard things about consciousness because. Like, it is a very deeply personal, intimate thing. In some ways, it is the most core to what you are, this, like, witness. And you're just seeing things through this body, through these eyes, through the, you know. But if that is the consciousness experiencing itself, it should also be experiencing, like, the computer,
right.
All the activity happening in the circuits and the transistors and that information flowing. And so
sure.
It's just something I just wonder if is the universe already starting to experience itself not through a human experience, but through an AI experience. Maybe we need a tuner. Maybe we need a new antenna of some kind. Like there's like that, the piece of us that lets us connect or just experiencing it and name it or call it out. Like maybe that's missing.
Yeah.
But it's just something I've been wondering about.
No, it's a great thought. I mean, think about it this way. Like when you're dreaming, there's all these objects in the dream, right? There's tables, chairs, computers, you know. There could be an LLM in the dream. There could be anything in the dream. And
I have heard people talk about like they're dreaming and they have to like in the dream they wake up because they have to approve some. They have to approve a Claude Code command.
This is the inevitable result of vibe coding.
Dude, they shift auto mode. It's like this new mode in Claude Code. Oh my god, dude! I love it. So it's like. I guess it's not, okay, I haven't looked into this. It's terrible. I've just literally used it a little bit. I was like trying it last night. I guess it's a little bit better than dangerously skip permissions, but it does kind of have like a big warning, but it'll just run, it like won't interrupt. Like, dude, you just feel like you're flying with this.
And that whole permissions thing is so annoying. I've actually been reading studies about, because I'm designing some stuff for my system where I want user approval, but also like, not where it's actually effective user approval. It's not just security feature. And there's all this really interesting research about like how quick it takes humans to habituate the approvals. They're like, do all this analysis. They're like, within 2 weeks, it doesn't matter who you are, mindless yeah. approvals, rubber stamp everything. And there's these ways of, I don't know if you see in iOS, sometimes it'll pop up and it'll say, this app asked you for your location yes. 50 times. So that's like a newer technique where it's like even after you approve something, it kind of explains the result of the approval and okay. like whether or not you want to still. But like there's all this stuff you have to do to make the approvals actually mean something and not just be useless. And that's kind of where they are now with Claude Code and like why they're developing those kinds of features is because you're not really getting much security out of it because after 2 weeks, you're just approving yeah. everything mindlessly. But you are getting a ton of friction and getting slowed down dramatically where it's like, oh, my thing is just waiting for me to hit enter and I'm on some other repo or looking at some other instance, and it could have been, you know, token maxing, and it's just sitting there doing nothing.
Yep.
But anyway, the thing, the dream, everything in the dream is made out of your consciousness. Literally. Like, you don't have to be some mystical,
right?
Like,
no, of course.
You know, woo-woo thing. Like, the things in the dream are made out of your mind or your, you know. And in addition, it's not just that it's like made out of your consciousness, like this sort of the substance of your imagination or whatever. Like, it is also embodying your psyche. Like, that's why dream analysis is a thing, right? Where mm-hmm. it's like the objects in the dream are not just neutral or random. Like, they each represent something you're feeling or something you're thinking about or something that you're going through, something about you, the person. So, like, the... you know, like, there's the classic one, you feel like your teeth are falling out or something, and that's like some fear of you have no control or whatever it is, right? So it's like the in the dream, there's these teeth that are made out of your consciousness and they're falling out, and that falling out is telling you something about the being who has the consciousness. So if by analogy we are in God's dream, and everything is made out of like God's consciousness, including us.
Mm-hmm.
And so including the AI, including the LLM, which means that everything has a symbolic representation of the essence of what that entity is. Everything is a story about what God really is, including the AI, including anything that can happen in this reality is some way of explaining or telling a story about the unified essence behind it all.
The existence. It's wild. It's wild. So I think, you think God wants more software?
I mean...
We're about to get a lot more software, dude.
If not, God is like making a huge oversight, because the whole thing seems to be wired to create a lot of software if we're not software itself.
You know, right. Well,
the universe as software or
right?
simulation theory. But yeah, maybe that's a good note to end on.
Yeah, I think so. It's a fun rip.
Kind of ultimate thing. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see. As we try to find our audience, you know.
Yeah, I wonder if that's too much or if people want more of that or less of that or.
Yeah, other... like I feel like we're too woo-woo for the technical people and we're too technical for the woo-woo.
Yes,
people.
I feel totally so in that camp.
If you're like somehow like us where you traverse those two things, like this is clearly the podcast for you. And let us know whether you enjoy it and whether you have any thoughts and whether this spurred any thinking or questioning, or you think it's just all BS and like, what is this ridiculous like ideas about consciousness? Like, let us know. We want to engage. We want to think about it. We want to question and wonder alongside whoever happens to have made it this long to the end. So,
yeah, thank you for watching. Let us know. And got a lot more fun conversations coming in the future.
Yep. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
All right.